This is Empty, the Atari 8-bit podcast.
On this episode of Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast, we shop for Atari goodies at the world's longest yard sale, hobnob with Woz at Kansas Fest, and interview the founder and publisher of Antic magazine. Let's go! Hello there! Welcome to another thrill-packed episode of Antic, the Atari podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to talk about the vintage Atari 8-bit line of computers. We're going to cover news, talk about history, present interviews, discuss the various Atari 8-bit computers and their capabilities, and even delve into the occasional technical topic. We want this to be fun for all, even if your favorite computer is the TRS-80 or the Sinclair Spectrum. We want you to be able to learn something about Atari computers and why they hold a special place in our hearts. This is episode 3, and that means I'm Brad Arnold, and I'll be your host. And I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Randy Kindig and Kevin Savitz. What you been up to, Kevin?
I have been having fun. I went to Kansas Fest, which is an Apple II, 5-day-long Apple II festival. And I know this is an Atari podcast, and I'm sorry, but there is no 5-day-long Atari festival that I'm aware of.
Maybe we should start one,
Let's
Kevin.
Start one. That's great.
Yeah,
let's do that.
Yeah, I like that.
In the meantime, I went to Kansas City, Missouri, and I hung out with the Apple II people. And let me tell you, I had a great time. There was a fantastic group of 62 of us, I think, were there. And we stayed at the dorms in Rutgers University. And it was just 24 hours a day of Apple II fun. I highly recommend it, even as an Atari person. So I wanted to talk about just a couple of the highlights for me. I brought my Raspberry Pi computer, which I have this little computer that I've never actually used, and I thought I'd bring it and maybe get it started, run an Apple emulator, an Atari emulator on it. And I never really got to that because I was distracted by so many of the other fun things there. So every year they do a Hackfest, and people do all sorts of interesting projects, and I was inspired to do an entry into the Hackfest, which was one of the most fun things for the week. I guess last year at Kansas Fest, I wasn't there, this is my first one, last year at Kansas Fest, someone wrote a game called Structress. And Structress is a game, imagine someone else, the computer is playing Tetris, right? And so these Tetris pieces are falling, and you are a little dot that tries not to get squished by the falling Tetris pieces. It's a fun little game. And there was a tournament to play Structress as one of the many activities there, and I was invited to enter the tournament, and I didn't do that well. But I thought, I'm not good at this game, but I wonder if I could write a program that could play the game better than I could. So my Hackfest entry was I wrote a program in AppleSoft Basic to play the Structress game.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So have you programmed in AppleSoft Basic
before? Well, I had. It's been a very long time, but it came back to me amazingly fast, and it was close enough to Atari Basic that I figured out what I needed to figure out, but remembered some important parts. Yeah, so I wrote this program to play the Structress game, and it came in third in the Hackfest, and I got a free book for my efforts. Had a great time with that.
I have to say, I saw the Kansas Fest sent out some notices of things that were going on during the show and after the show, mm-hmm. and I saw your name in there for the Structress tournament, and I wondered what that was all about. And then when you had the notes for this show, I went and downloaded that application and installed the Apple emulator on my PC here and ran it. It's fun. I'm not very good at it, but I'm impressed that you could write a program to play that game.
Well, the ultimate goal would be to have the program be able to play the game perfectly, and it couldn't. By the time I was done, there's 10 levels in the game, and by the time I was done, the program could on average, make it to level 7 before it died. Sometimes it would die on level 1 or 2. Sometimes it would make it to the end and finish the game. Anyway, but it was a lot of fun to do.
Neat.
Another neat thing that happened there, I probably should have led with this, but Steve Wozniak showed up.
Yes, I heard about that. I am so jealous.
Nobody really knew. There were a couple people, you know, behind the scenes that knew, but he just showed up. And he couldn't have been more gracious, and he was signing things, and he was talking to people and shaking hands, and he's just such a nice guy. And the thing that really, like, drove home to me, like, how interested he is still in the Apple II, was he shows up and he's talking to people, and then when the talks start, he sat down and he sat in the audience and he listened, you know, and he just paid attention, and he wasn't there to be like a diva or anything. He's genuinely interested. But it's cool because when someone says something like, you know, the Apple II disk drive used such and such a part, once in a while he'd raise his hand and go, "Do you want to know why we use that part?" And of course everyone's just like, yeah. So it was amazing.
I heard that he might try to come again next year.
Yeah, he said he's going to try. You know, I'm sure he's a very busy guy, but we'll see what happens. So another fun thing, getting away from yeah, Waz was there, and that was great. It was all these really technical stuff. It's like there was a talk about, you know, how you can hack a game in order to bypass the disk protection. And one guy came out with like a baggie full of parts, and he's like, dumps the parts onto the table. It's like, these are the parts of an Apple II disk drive. Let's put it together so it works. And you can like watch him do it. It was kind of amazing. But wow. So a lot of really techie stuff. But one of my favorite sessions was really low tech. They brought out piles of pretty paper, like scrapbooking paper, and X-Acto knives. And we made custom floppy disk sleeves. They showed us how to cut paper and then fold it origami style to make floppy disk sleeves.
There's a trade you can use.
Right. So just like three tables long, full of geeks, like having a great time doing this low tech, like craft, you know, we're going to do crafts today. Yay. It was totally fun. And another highlight for me was we had kind of a bunch of podcasters there. Carrington Vaston and Mike McGinnis and Ken Gagne were all there, and we did a joint podcast. We called it Open Antic Hertz because of it was a combination of Open Apple and Antic and 1 MHz. And we all just sat down and we recorded a podcast together. It's a special edition of the Open Apple podcast with all four of us. And there'll be a link to that in the show notes if you just really want to hear more about the fun at Kansas Fest.
Yeah, I listened to that one already, and it did sound like a lot of fun. I'm going to have to go one day.
Yeah, I listened to the Waz interview, too, just today, in fact, from Open Apple.
I haven't heard that one yet.
That's good.
Yeah, and he's got a video up now, too.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it, but I've listened to both the podcasts as soon as they came out.
So, Kevin, I have to say that you did a good job of plugging this podcast, because we suddenly got a lot of downloads for a extended period of time after that podcast. So,
oh, really? Excellent.
Kudos for plugging this show.
Yeah, I do what I can. So, I have one other interesting thing, personal thing to talk about, And this is kind of exciting for me, but I have a question for you guys. You get an email from a guy named Yazid in the country of Jordan, and he claims he has a super rare Atari 8-bit. What do you do?
I'm not sure. I would probably ignore it, is what I would probably do.
Brad?
I'm not sure I would see it, because it'd probably be in my spam box.
That's a good point.
So yeah, I get this email.
So what did you do, Kevin?
Well, here's what I did. I get this email from this guy named Yazid in Jordan, and he says, I have a rare Arabic language 65XE, and do you want it? And so a little backstory here is I already have one of these computers. which I got years ago, and I have a web page about it. It's an Atari 65XE with modified ROMs, that so it works in Arabic and in English, and a keyboard that has both Arabic and English letters on it. So I guess he had this computer, and he Googled it, and he found me, and he basically emailed me and said, I have this machine. Do you want it? And so I was like, didn't know what to do. I mean, yeah, I would love to have another one of these machines, but can I trust him? So I decided to throw caution to the wind, and we worked out a deal, and I PayPal'd him a sum of money. And a week later, DHL shows up with an Arabic 65XE.
Cool.
I would say not very many people can claim that in the United States.
Right. And I might have the world's largest collection of Arabic 65XEs now that I have two. And the new one is different from the old one. The new one works in PAL, and the original one I had from 10 or 15 years ago works in NTSC. But other than that, they're basically the same, and it's in beautiful condition, and there's no yellowing, and I'm thrilled to have it in my collection. So there'll be a link in the show notes. You'll be able to see pictures of both Arabic machines, and it was just exciting. I threw caution to the wind, and I ended up with a rare Atari machine.
Yeah, it's excellent. Nice.
What about you, Randy? Beat that.
I can't beat that. I definitely cannot beat that. I am very jealous you got to go to Kansas Fest, and certainly hope to try to go one day, maybe next year. Especially since I know Woz is going to try to go next year. I'll bet they will sell out of tickets for next year's show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I certainly can't beat that, but I did do something computer related. I went on the world's longest yard sale. And of course, the only reason I go to these things, my wife has all these things she is looking for, of course, for the home. I'm always looking for computer items. And that's the only reason that I go on these things. But it starts in, I believe it's in Alabama, and goes all the way to Michigan. It's along Highway 127.
Wow.
And we decided this year we were going to start in Tennessee. We started in Kentucky last year and head north towards, back towards Indiana. And we drove a lot of miles and stopped at a lot of yard sales. Unfortunately, I only found one item that I purchased, and that was a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk holder. I did see one other vintage computer. It was I can't remember what it was now. It was one of the old portable, one of the first portable machines. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, the reason I go on these is mainly hope. And, you know, once in a while you come across something. I have come across, for instance, one year for this yard sale, I did come across an 800XL and a 1050 drive just sitting out there in the middle of the table. I think I paid $20 for both of them. They didn't have the power supplies, and I didn't know if they worked or not, but I told the guy I'd give him $20. I brought him home, and believe it or not, the drive worked and the XL didn't. I thought, if anything, the drive would be more sensitive to being out in the elements than the XL would, but sure. I still ended up selling the XL to somebody who could fix it. And one time I came across an Atari 400, just forlornly sitting on top of a pile, and I got it pretty cheaply too. I rescued it, and mainly just to rescue it, and I already had a 400, and then I sold it on eBay just to find a good home for it. So I'm kind of I'm out there looking for machines to rescue as much as anything. But that was fun.
How long is the world's longest yard sale?
Oh, that's a good question. If it starts in Alabama and goes all the way to Michigan, it must obviously be several hundred miles long. But I honestly don't know how long it is. Pretty darn long. And there are a lot of people that go to this thing. So that's my big story. I also got some computer books. Are you guys familiar with Better World Books?
No.
It's an online book seller that has a lot of used books, and they usually sell them at a very reasonable price. And I've acquired a lot of not only Atari, but you know, a lot of vintage computer books for my collection from Better World Books. Occasionally, they will have a sale where you buy, it's like every book you buy, you get out of their bargain bin, you get a second one free. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, I normally go in there and I look and see, you know, what books they have that I don't already have in my collection, and I'll buy a bunch of them and get them for, you know, very, very reasonable price. So I got 8 books. Unfortunately, they didn't have any Atari ones this time, but I did get Commodore and PC Junior, and I got the TRS-80 edition of Basic Computer Games. I got 8 books for $27 with shipping. One of the books is even, if you look on Amazon, it goes for $50. And basically, I got it for $3.
Wow.
So, I've just, I will have a link to Better World Books on the show notes. But if you're in the market for more books to round out your collection, that's certainly a good place to go. And then, besides that, I've been working on my next Floppy Days episode, which is going to be on the Commodore PET. And that should be coming out in the next week or so. So, Brad, what have you been up to?
Oh, me? Well, unfortunately, work and life have gotten in the way of any real fun lately. One thing, though, is after last month's podcast, the Atlanta Historical Computing Society did have our periodic video game day. And on my Ataris that I brought, pretty much the only game that was played was Star Raiders. And once I booted up Star Raiders, nobody wanted to play anything else. So
That is a great game.
Oh, yeah. It actually kind of surprised me is one of the Atari guys there hadn't played Star Raiders in so long. He says, I have never played Star Raiders. It's like, what? Wait a minute. This is not right.
No, it isn't.
So
that's like one of the first games you own when you get an Atari.
Yeah, he didn't have a Star Raiders, so it's like, fortunately, I have like 3, so I loaned him one of mine until he can find one of his own. And so I figured that was my good deed for the month. Got to be able to play Star Raiders.
Absolutely. And you, of course, you have to have the key so you know what all the commands are.
Yeah. And but fortunately, actually, I don't have the website link handy, but someone has scanned actually it's in several different places, but the manual for Star Raiders is online, and in several places it's good scans of it, so it's easy to find. And now for the news.
So I think the first item is mine. It has to do with the new F7 turbo card that's being developed. It's an accelerator card being developed for the Atari 8-bit line. A company called Lotharac is developing an accelerator card under the name of the F7 turbo card. It's actually inserted into the expansion port of the XL and XE computers, and it has its own memory. They have a video that shows how fast Rescue on Fractalus will run with this accelerator card, and I guess it's really pretty amazing how quickly that will run as compared to the stock machine. It does have a mode that also allows its 64K memory to replace the Atari's memory and use it somehow to perform some magic. It will support up to 14.5 megabytes of RAM and has 512 kilobytes of flash memory. So that's pretty substantial. They're also working on an adapter that will support the memory expansion that they also offer called Ultimate 1 Megabyte, so that this adapter will support that particular memory upgrade. It if you remember in, was it our last show or our first show, we talked about the Accelerator Rapidus card. I think, Brad, you talked about it a little bit. And this is similar to that in that it replaces the 6502 with the W65C816, which operates at 16 megahertz. So it really boosts the speed on the machine. What do you guys think of this?
It looks like fun. I hope they come out with it.
Yeah, me, I'm kind of torn between between this for my 800XL and getting an incognito card for my Atari 800.
What's an incognito?
Well, it's kind of a Swiss Army knife of the Atari 800 modifications. It's got extra RAM. It's got extra storage. It has switchable operating systems. It has the BIOS for the XL and XEs. You can actually run XL and XE software on your Atari 800. Hmm. And it does a couple other different things. And I think that may show up as its own future tech topic.
Definitely.
Cool.
And I think it's just great that people are out there still developing enhancements for the machines. Just makes them, you know, a little more fun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I have a bit of news, and I got to come out and say it at the beginning. You're going to get excited at first, and then there's a letdown at the end. It's you're going to don't get too excited. So there's a new game, I think, called Alien 8 out for the Atari, and I believe it's ported from a game on the Sinclair Spectrum, which is a computer that I don't know anything about. So first of all, I discovered a blog an Atari blog that I hadn't seen before called atariteca.blogspot.com. It's all in Spanish. They seem to have great Atari news, but I don't really read Spanish, so it makes it difficult. But as far as I can tell, there's this game called Alien 8, which originally came out for the Sinclair Spectrum, and it looks really cool, and there's a robot that you walk around, and you have a mission to keep the crew on the spaceship alive, and it looks kind of amazing, and there's a video on YouTube where you can see someone playing the game, and I wanted to play the game, so I clicked the download link. 404, page not found. It's like, what? No! So I Googled around and I looked on Atari Age, and it seems like a real thing, but I can't find the binaries to download and actually play it myself.
So maybe they're not done with it yet, or it's not quite ready. Oh, no.
I see the Atari Teca has a download link, but when I click it, it doesn't work. So maybe they took it down. I don't know.
Well, the fandao.cz is where it goes.
Yeah.
That website recently went down, and that's actually a discussion topic right now. Everybody's trying to figure out where he went. He just vanished last week.
Wow.
And so,
well, hopefully he's got a mirror set up or something.
And yeah, that's what everybody's trying to do right now, scratch together mirrors and see what's going on. But yeah, it was there up until last week.
Well, I should have hopped on it faster.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the next thing I wanted to mention is remind everybody that the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest is coming up September 28th and 29th in Chicago. And I've been there the last 3 years and plan to go again this year. At this point, I think my wife just puts up with it. She always goes along, but she goes shopping while I'm at the festival. But there's always an Atari presence there. There's a group called SCAT that's in the Chicago area, and they always come, and they always have a display there and several different Atari computers set up. So I thought I might try to get an interview with them while I'm there. Either one of you planning on attending or trying to attend?
No, I haven't heard about this.
You never heard of this one? It's this is like version 9, I think. It's either version 8 or version 9. So it's been going on for a while. And I would definitely recommend it. It's not quite as formal maybe, or as professionally done as the Southeast one was. Mm-hmm. But it's still a lot of fun, and there's a lot of computers and a lot of people. So,
well, we expect a full report.
You will get one.
Okay, next in news, I have several tiny little news bites, little just nibbles to that might be of interest. We can move through them really fast. One of them is there's this new downloadable album CD thing out called Memories of Infocom, which is music inspired by classic interactive fiction. And according to the composer, these pieces of music will transport you from ancient empires to crime scenes to outer space and beyond. Looking at the song titles, I mean, they're called Zork, Deadline, Starcross, Enchanter, Suspended, A Mind Forever Voyaging. So he just named the songs after classic Infocom games, and it might be interesting to somebody. The music's kind of electronic soundscape things, and I don't know. It wasn't my cup of tea, but it's $10 to download the album, and it might be.
I may have to look at that, because I like putting on music like that while I'm at work, just to drown out the background noise at work.
Sure, yeah.
And not too distracting, but something that'll kind of white noise-ish.
The thing is, listening to this music, I wouldn't listen to one and go, oh yeah, this totally... If it didn't tell me that I was listening to Zork, then I probably wouldn't know.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I never really got into adventure games.
Here's a... I'll just drop in a sample of a couple seconds of the Zork song right now. Next up, I saw something interesting on that AtariTeka.blogspot.com. Someone is doing digital art that uses Atari graphics, combining Atari graphics with real landscapes. For instance, there is a desert scene, cactuses and stuff, with one of a pixelated guy from Shootout. There is a beautiful bucolic scene with the cows and the cowboy from the Stampede game. They're really cute. They're fun to look at, and I threw a link up in the show notes if you want to look at some Atari-inspired art.
I love the Stampede one. That's just cute.
Yeah, it's cute. And there's a fisherman guy from I don't know what game, maybe a 2600 game, where you're fishing and he's fishing in a real stream.
Yeah. I like these.
Next up in my little news bits, I learned about this at Kansas Fest. Juiced.gs, which is a print magazine for Apple II people, has a new little booklet thing, a PDF, that might be of interest to Atari users. It's called the Juiced.gs Concentrate Interactive Fiction, and it's a little $8 PDF that has all sorts of four different articles about interactive fiction. There's a review of Nick Monfort's Twisty Little Passages book, and they talk about Get Lamp, Jason Scott's documentary on the history of interactive fiction. And there is information about a couple of other more recent text adventure games. So if you're into interactive fiction, you might want to look at the interactive fiction Concentrate PDF from juice.gs.
Sounds good. The next time I'm going to cover, this is an Atari podcast, so I thought people might be interested in knowing how Atari the corporation is doing these days. And since our last show, they've held a series of auctions, actually occurred July 16th through the 19th, selling off their prized assets to the highest bidder. I think, as most of you know, they were going pretty much going under, and they decided that in order to pay off their creditors, they were going to have to sell off a lot of their assets. So although the auction process is over. There isn't any news yet as far as what's going to happen with the Atari brand and what Atari classes as its classic intellectual properties. It's very clear they owe a lot of people a lot of money. And they're including people like Nolan Bushnell, who has a claim for $24,000, and Kristen Keller, who is Atari's legal counsel. Also, Atari's French parent company, Atari SA, and its French subsidiary, Atari Europe SAS, are making claims against Atari Inc. and Atari Interactive for quite a bit of money. In fact, Atari SA is seeking over $261 million from Atari Interactive.
Yikes.
Yeah. I can't imagine they think they're going to get much, if any, of that money.
Yeah.
But it just seems odd that Atari's parent is turning on its own children. And the theory is that French Atari maybe is trying to get its paws on the company name so it can spin the wheel another time. Because there are a lot of people who think the Atari name might have some mileage left in it.
What's this make, like 5 or 6 times Atari has gone down? I've lost track.
I've lost count.
I just wanted to quickly mention, you guys, I don't know if you're familiar with Terry Stewart, but he has done a lot of classic computer demonstrations on YouTube over the past year, probably. And he's pretty much taking every machine that's in his collection and doing a video on just some of the basics of using that machine. Are you guys familiar with these?
No.
Tezza.
Tezza, yeah.
Yeah.
And you can find him on YouTube just to search for Tezza or Terry Stewart, either one. But he recently did an Atari 800XL demonstration. And previously, I think about 8 or 9 months ago, he did one on the Atari 400 as well. So they're, you know, obviously, I don't think we're going to learn a lot about them by watching them, but it's just interesting, and they're very, very well done.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I like all of his videos. Last episode, we talked about a Kickstarter game called Seriously, and it looks like that its Kickstarter has failed. In an email to backers, Roger Hector has said, "Al and I just wanted to say thanks to all of you who stepped up and backed this project. It seems we underestimated the marketing requirements of Kickstarter and didn't effectively get the word out. But we've learned a lot during this process and still have a great deal of confidence in our game. So we'll just find another way to get it made." And it looks like their final numbers were $5,161 out of a $100,000 goal.
Well, they only missed it by a little bit.
Yeah.
Missed it by that much.
Yeah, that much. I think next time they need to capitalize on Al Alcorn's name a little bit more. And although, honestly, that gets our attention, but is the general public going to know Al Alcorn?
No.
They should.
Yeah.
You know, they should, but will they? You know, but yeah, actually at first I wasn't particularly impressed with the game. It was, to me, it just sounded like a kind of another You Don't Know Jack knockoff, and I like You Don't Know Jack, but I actually heard an interview with him on a different podcast, and he went into I guess it was Roger Hector went into some detail on how it was played and some other things, and it actually sounded mildly interesting. And you know, yes, they acknowledge it was a twist on You Don't Know Jack, but it was their twist, and it actually sounded kind of good. So if they restart it, I may have to pay more attention to it next time.
Well, I think they'll find another way to get it done if they're motivated. Yeah. Kickstarter is the latest fad.
Yeah.
Popular way to get things done, but they're certainly not the only way to get something like this accomplished.
No, that's very true. David Grealish has released an ebook version of Historically Brewed. You can get it for $7.99 by going to classiccomputing.com, and a link to that will be in the show notes.
Awesome. And speaking of books, I wanted to talk about some of the new Atari book scans available at archive.org. As people upload new Atari books, I just try to keep an eye on them and see what is coming down the pipeline. In manuals, there's several new manuals, including The Home Accountant, Family Finances, and the manual for the Atari 410 Program Recorder. So, yeah, I know. You can figure out how to finally use that tape drive after all these years. I'm more excited about the field service manuals that have appeared. The Atari System Reference Manual is available, as well as the Atari 400-800 Field Service Manual and the Atari 800XL Field Service Manual. Here's why I love these manuals. Just filled with every bit of information you could want to know about the technical internals of the hardware, you know, pinouts and that sort of thing. But if your computer's not working, there's flowcharts that say, okay, you know, turn it on. Do you see memo pad? No? Okay, well, then do this and that. If you do see memo pad, is there color or is it black and white? If black and white, well, you know, then this is probably wrong. Check this. So if you have a computer that's not quite working right or not working at all, this will give you like the exact steps that Atari Repair used to use back in the day in order to get it back to functional.
I can say I don't own any of these books, so it does sound great though.
They are great. You don't need to own them. You can just download them or view them online at archive.org.
Yeah, but I like to have the real thing in my hands.
Okay.
Actually, you know, these I used to like the real thing, and actually I still do like have the real thing. But I've gotten really good mileage lately out of downloading PDFs to my iPad and having that set next to me while I'm working on something.
Hmm. I agree. Digital certainly has its place, but I still like the physical book.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, you ought to see my wall of books over here. Okay, listener feedback. We've got some listener feedback.
Yay!
On the Atari Age forums, West of House says, great second show, guys. I love the podcast, but it's hazardous to listen to while driving because hearing the Atari demo music makes me want to curl up in a ball and weep for my lost childhood. Sigh.
Aw, that's the saddest feedback ever. I'm so sorry, West of House. That demo music, which we play at the top of the show, makes me so happy. And it totally reminds me of hanging out in the Kmart, like, lusting for an Atari 800. And that's why I chose it. Sorry it makes you feel differently.
I wanted to add, too, we've had several comments and feedback on iTunes, which is great. We appreciate everybody doing that. So there's really nothing I wanted to point out in particular as far as the feedback, other than the ratings have been great, and we really appreciate the feedback.
And now, a word from our bankrupt sponsor.
Buying a Commodore 64 computer would make you smart. But buying a 65XE from Atari would be smarter. Both have the same amount of memory, both have typewriter-style keyboards, but the XE has better graphics, better sound, more colors, and it's faster with thousands of software programs, including the best games. And for under $100, it blows the Commodore away. The XE computers from Atari, starting at under $100.
So for the feature topic this podcast, I interviewed the founder and publisher of Antic magazine, Jim Caporel. Now, Jim was publisher of Antic and also Start magazine, which was for the Atari ST computers, and also Two Computing, which was a magazine for the Apple II and Amiga Plus. But I talked to him mostly about Antic, which was really one of the big two computer magazines. As far as I'm concerned, there was Antic and there was Analog. And Antic was published between from April 1982 to June 1990. And it was an incredible magazine and really a big part, I think, of the Atari ecosystem back in the day. And
oh, yes.
I interviewed Jim, and I'm about to play for you the best parts of the interview, but we don't have time to play the whole thing here. So the complete uncut interview, which goes on for almost an hour and a half, will be available up at archive.org, and the link will be in the show notes at ataripodcast.com. So if you're a glutton and you want to hear me talking to Jim for an hour and a half, you can do that. But here's the most interesting bits from Jim Caporel, founder of Antic Magazine.
I was raised in Rochester, New York, mm-hmm. but my grandfather emigrated from Italy in the turn of the century, 1900s, 1910 or something, and from a town outside Naples.
Was Antic your first magazine?
Yeah, yeah. I was a professional programmer for a long time in Silicon Valley. And the job I was working at the time, I was working at NASA Ames Research Center at Moffett Field in Sunnyvale. Mm-hmm. And I was in the programmer for a small research group. We were researching motion sickness, and so I was in Silicon Valley quite a while, actually, all through the 70s, and doing programming. And and the last job I had was at Moffett Field at NASA, and we were using biofeedback to control motion sickness. Anyway, I got I started a computer cult called the Atari Bay Area Computer User Society, Abacus for short, and started a newsletter. And I think that's the magazine Antic sprang from the newsletter.
I did not know that.
The idea, the notion of a magazine. And I remember pacing the floor one Sunday making pancakes and trying to think of a name for the new magazine, this idea I had. And I was coming up with all these names, and of course I was very familiar with the Atari 800 internals. And Antic, as you well know, was the alphanumeric television interface controller chip. Mm-hmm. That was an acronym. And it was the chip that really allowed the Atari to be such a powerful graphics box because, as I'm sure you know, you could interrupt every scan line. And that's what gave Atari its tremendous game playing power, along with the sprites and so on. But it was the Antic chip. So I got the name Antic, and literally within a few minutes, we thought of this cockeyed kind of typeface, and I was the model for the first cover. And that's I'd never done magazines before. I just was off and running.
So I guess my next question was going to be, and I think you've started to answer it, was did you set off as an Atari guy who thought you should start a magazine, or did you start off as, I'm going to start a business, it's going to be a magazine about Ataris because that's where people want to read?
No, I came really from my enthusiasm for the home computer business, which happened, and I got pulled in the direction of Atari. The reason was, going back to my NASA story at Moffett Field, doing this biofeedback, I was the research programmer and a lot of data, and I contacted Apple and I contacted Atari and asked them to give me equipment. I was not making a lot of dough. I was on a research contract, and Atari gave me the equipment. This was in 82. Mm-hmm. But for the 4 or 5 years prior to that, I probably collected every computer magazine around. Byte, Microcomputing, Creative Computing. I had so many magazines that at one point, the Chinese consulate got wind of it and bought them all from me in San Francisco. They had heard about my collection, and I sold them all to the Chinese consulate. So I'd get all the magazines and take them home and read them all. And also, I think that's what got me interested in doing my own magazine as well. It was in my subconscious, in a sense. I'd read them all for 4-6 years. And Antic became probably the most successful of all the Atari magazines. I believe it was. Yeah, it had the biggest circulation and the widest distribution worldwide. We had subscribers all over the world. We were the first magazine to include a bound-in floppy disk. I was the first magazine to... Actually, a lot of people did program listings,
sure.
Type them in. I might have been the first to include a checksum with it. When you typed in the basic program, we had a checksum program, so you could tell if you'd made a mistake.
Typo.
Yeah. Yeah.
You did the early issues on your kitchen table.
My initial, where we launched it, was I had an apartment at the corner of 18th and Missouri Street in San Francisco on Potrero Hill. And literally, we worked out of there. I introduced the first issue of the magazine at the West Coast Computer Fair, and schlepped them all over there. And thinking that I was going to get rid of all of them, of course I didn't. I had printed, I think, 12,000, and had 10,000 left by the time I was done. And I went, Jesus, now what? Well, now what is that? I went to the library and I got all the yellow pages. This is before internet. Got all and started calling computer stores nationwide and selling my magazine to them. And that's how I unloaded 10,000 magazines. And, of course, at the time, people were receptive. They just needed to know about it. And I picked up the phone and I would start early in the morning and start calling the East Coast. And so, you know, if I started calling at 6, it was 9 on the East Coast. And I get a lot of calls. And so a guy became my distribution manager, worked for me for a number of years. Les Torek was his name. And he did started doing the shipping. And I remember we schlepped all these magazine boxes, wrapped them up, and take them over to UPS, which wasn't too far from my Missouri Street address. I was there probably on the fourth day with 20 boxes. And the guy said, "You're going to be doing this a lot?" I said, "Every day." He said, "You know, UPS will come by and pick up." I said, "They will?" Well, that shows you the level of my sophistication. I didn't know that.
Awesome.
Yeah. And we grew, added other magazines. And I think at one time we had 65 people working there.
Wow.
You know, I had mail order business. I had a couple of other magazines. Hmm. So it grew pretty nicely over those few years from 82 to 90. What consumed those of us involved in the home computer phenomenon was some underlying feeling that compelled us to pursue this thing. It was fascinating. It was interesting. It was empowering. There was a sense that this was the beginning of something, and we just couldn't get enough of it. So, whatever your age, it was this notion. This feeling that ran through all of us, I think.
How'd you get your first advertisers?
So I sold all the ads. And the way I did, I got on the phone again early in the morning. So if I wasn't selling to somebody, convincing them to carry my magazine, I was talking to somebody about advertising in the magazine. I remember talking to a guy. I said, you know, I told him about what I was doing. He said, yeah, well, that's pretty interesting. I said, well, have you ever done a magazine before? I said, no. He said, do you ever sell advertising? I said, no. He said, do you have any distribution? I said, I'm working on it. He said, give me a full page. I answered no just about any important question he asked.
Right, yeah.
But I'll tell you something that I used to say to everyone. My uncle, who was an attorney, a successful one in Silicon Valley, he said, listen, he said, you're enthusiastic. And he said, my experience is that in business, enthusiasm can make up for almost everything. And I never forgot that. And he was absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And it's called many things now. I'm sure you're on the internet as much as I am with all the new stuff going on, these apps and new websites, and a lot of it's derivative stuff, in my opinion. But people are quite successful. It's interesting to me to read their analysis of their business and their tips, you know, from the great entrepreneurs of the day. The great entrepreneurs, of course, are those who have made $1 billion.
Right.
That's what great is. I never see this written, but it underlies a lot of what's said anecdotally, as well as the tablets from the mountaintop. This is what so-and-so said. Well, I'll tell you what I say. Enthusiasm makes up for everything. If you don't have it, you won't succeed. If you don't have the passion, the compelling drive, you'll have a very difficult time. So I was fortunate in that I didn't know what I didn't know. And believe me, there was a ton. I didn't know anything about publishing.
Yeah.
Nothing. The woman I lived with at the time, Marnie Tabscott was her name, she was working as a typesetter. So that's how we got the first issue typeset. Hmm. She did it off hours.
Well.
And then she and I pasted it up. I didn't know anything about paste up, but I learned pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you one story. I used to keep the subscription list.
Mm-hmm.
On the Atari.
Okay.
I had a database. I used to use Synapse's database. Remember Synapse?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. They were good friends of mine. I remember one time printing out, so we got the magazines in. Now we had to mail them. So printing out all the labels on a Centronics dot matrix printer.
Mm-hmm.
So the labels, printing them out, then sticking them on the covers. And then in my apartment, sorting them by zip code. So, you know, where's Minnesota? It's over there. We'd throw it, you know, so we had stacks of magazines. And then we had to bundle them, tie them and bundle them. Mm-hmm. And then I had to schlep them down to the main post office on in those days in San Francisco. It was on Mission Street. And it was an old building built in by the Works Project Administration in the Depression. Great old murals and so on. Mm-hmm. So I had to take them there. Every issue, remember, we did an issue a month. Did we start by month?
Oh, you started off every other month.
Yeah, I started off every other
month. And after the first year, you switched to month.
Yeah, that's right. I remember one time I had a little Subaru loaded in the back with sacks of magazines, taking them down to Mission Street in a second. And this was around the holidays, so it was wintry, and for San Francisco that means rainy. And I was driving down south of Market, can't remember the street. The lights were out, all the lights in that part of town were out, the street lights and so on. So everyone was stop and go. I stopped at an intersection. Someone drove into me, drove their car into me, full speed, drove into me, crash, drove me right through the intersection across. People came running out thinking somebody's got to be dead in this thing. There wasn't a scratch on the car. Not a scratch. And nobody could believe it, including me. There wasn't a scratch on the car. How could that happen? To this day. And I know it was the holidays because I said, well, everyone, that's your Christmas miracle.
Yeah.
Because nobody could believe it. Everyone thought I was dead. These guys got to be dead. The guy just drove into them full speed. There wasn't a scratch on the car.
Huh.
To this day, that's a true story. And where I was going was to deliver the magazines down to the main post office, which has since moved out to China Basin.
So as I was reading through the issues, just kind of going through editorial after editorial and letters from people, just trying to find trends, what I did see was like campaigns to write to publishers. Like over the course of years, Antic seemed like it was driving these campaigns to like tell software publishers to support Atari.
I don't remember that.
I was going to ask if that was like an agenda on your.
I'm sure it was. Remember, we were passionate Atari people.
Yeah.
And Atari was getting the short end of the stick. You know, for when I first started, it was owned by
Warner Communications.
Time Warner. It was typical corporate America, in that they didn't know what they had their hands on. They just didn't know. They thought it was a failing business. How is it that Nintendo came in and ended up owning the game market? It was just typical American corporate crap. They gave it up. They didn't have what it took to make it, you know, to win that business. They owned it, and they gave it up. Mm-hmm. They sold it to Jack, and that was the end of it.
Can you talk about your relationship with Atari before and after the Tremels took over? I mean, was there editorial pressure? Did they ignore you? Did they help you?
They didn't give a shit. I shouldn't say they didn't. Jack was a street fighting guy. He understood the role, the ecosystem, the magazine, but he wasn't about to give me any undue credit. But I remember having parties and inviting him and his family, his sons. I knew all the sons. Mm-hmm. Sig Hartman, I knew Sig pretty well. And they would attend our parties. They weren't arrogant. Mm-hmm. Well, they were arrogant. They were not with me. They understood the ecosystem. I understood one. But in terms of the answer to your question, I received no pressure to say good or bad or indifferent things. They simply were about what they were about. And they had their, I think they felt, and probably rightfully, that they had their fate in their own hands. And I could help a little or hurt a little, but nothing that was significant.
So the last issue of Antic was June 1990, volume 9, number 2. And it seems to me, as a reader, that the end came as a surprise. You were still requesting programs in the last issue, and then all of a sudden it folded into Start. And then the end of Start came less than a year later, and that seemed like a surprise too.
I don't remember. Those were some painful years, actually.
Yeah.
You know, the end of this was a difficult time for me, and it sort of kind of came undone. Once again, you know, going back to what I said a few minutes ago, when driven by passion and commitment and belief, it's hard to witness the crumbling of this thing that you've helped create and that you've hung your the meaning of your life on, so to speak. And so it was some difficult times emotionally as well as real in the real business world, financially, and so on. And I suffered in a lot of different ways. So I really don't recall. I didn't know that was the last issue, and I guess, but it was the end. It was the end of those times, you know. Amiga and Atari were all failing. It was over. I really wasn't smart enough. I didn't migrate. I didn't get on with it. You know.
Yeah.
Probably my failing, actually.
You were one of the relatively few computer magazines to not sell out to a bigger publisher. IDG
I was offered.
Or Zip, were you? Tell me about it.
Yeah. In the first year, or the second year, that Antic was in business,
mm-hmm.
Pat McGovern, the owner of IDG,
mm-hmm.
Called me, asked for an appointment, came over to my apartment, stepped over all the boxes and shit. There he was in his, you know, very expensive suit.
Right.
Yeah. And nice guy, by the way. Smart guy. Nice guy. Hey, man, didn't give a shit about any of that. You know, it didn't bother him at all. He'd started that way himself and offered to buy it. And, I wasn't having any of it. I just turned it out.
Because it was still your passion?
Yeah. I mean, it was, I think, the second year. And I thought, I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't think I was thinking too straight. Probably, had I done that, things would have been different. But not necessarily better, I suppose.
It seems like you tried some other magazines back in the time. You tried an Amiga magazine for a few issues, right?
Amiga Plus. And that was out for more than a few issues, actually. Maybe a year. I don't know. It was out for a little bit.
And there was Two Computing, I think you did?
Apple Two Computing. And I think we ended up calling it Two Computing. I think we couldn't use the name Apple. I've forgotten how that worked. That was around for a while. And that was our desire to kind of expand, but that didn't work. So, I tried a bunch of different things trying to expand the business, basically. What I didn't do was hire professional publishers besides myself to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't invest in the business, mm-hmm. other than my own ideas.
What are you most proud of?
Oh, I think a couple things. I think the doing of it, the accomplishment over that period of time. I believe in the hiring people too. I have to tell you, I gave a lot of people a start in business. I was always sort of a maverick when it came to the principles of business and hiring and firing and so on. I probably wasn't the best boss all the time, but I gave a lot of people an opportunity. And the reason was, I didn't really care what you had done. I didn't care what your degree was in. I cared about you. What could you deliver? Going back to what I said earlier about passion and being, you know, you're lucky when you get people that work for you that have that, and you can't buy it, and you can't earn it, and you can't teach it. It just comes with the person that walks in the door. And I hired a lot of people looking for that, and just based on instinct, and was very happy to have a number of people working around me that were. I always look for people better than me, which was probably easy to find, actually, in a lot of ways. I was never frightened by smart, successful people. To me, that's what I wanted. I wanted people like that. I mean, who the hell wants morons around? I mean, I wanted people that could do more than I could do, not less. And was very fortunate to have a number of them. Had I been a better boss, we would have had a better business. Had I been it would have been better. There were opportunities there that I let get through my fingers, I think, both with people and the business opportunity itself, that I just didn't grasp. I didn't know how to develop them or allow them to develop. I'm most proud, I think, of that I hired a few hundred people, hundreds, over those years, and gave people their start. from 82 to 2001.
What was for you most frustrating or anger making?
Oh, just my own, I think retrospectively, my failings. That is, I used to run around, you know, every now and then think of the Marlon Brando speech in On the Waterfront. I could have been somebody, Charlie. You don't understand. I could have been somebody. Something along those lines.
Yeah. But it was, in other ways, it was a huge success. I mean, you created incredible community, and you brought people together. And
yep. But you got to understand, I was a driven guy, and the success for me, I could have been somebody, you know. But you're right. There was a big community, and the magazines were well-received and so on. So now we're here in Louisiana, and I'm helping Susan with Louisiana Kitchen and Culture. I do the website and the newsletter and the technology end of it, the FileMaker database for subscribers, and you know, all that kind of stuff, all the stuff I know how to do.
Do you own an Atari computer anymore?
You know, interesting. No, I don't. I don't know what happened to any of it. Are you on that Facebook page, the Atari Museum? And
yeah.
And I've seen pictures of all these old STs and Atari 800s and 400s, and it's kind of interesting to me because I haven't looked at it in 15 years, not longer. Yeah. So it's interesting to me to see all that since I was consumed by that stuff for a long time. And they're very familiar to me. You know, I had all of those floppy disks and the cartridge memory and the Atari 800 and monitors and all of that stuff.
If you could send a message to today's Atari hobbyists, and you can right now, what would you tell them?
I would say hang on to the equipment and your magazines. Hang on to... what's the term I'm looking for? The iconic stuff that representative of time that's only yesterday, but long gone, never be repeated. So it's over. There was a short period of time when it sort of came on the world so fast, and all of a sudden it consumed everybody. Not everyone. But you and I know who we're talking about. Everyone that we were friends with was consumed by the same thing.
Yeah.
Everyone else is wondering what the hell's going on. They were going, what is this with computers? What is it with you guys? What are you doing? And well, I don't know, but that's what we're interested in, and it just is all consuming. So there is something to it, and if you lived it, you want to hang on to some of that, not morbidly, but. I don't have any of it, and I got rid of it in some ways purposely. I just got rid of it, all that stuff. I don't have anything that reminds me of my successes or failures, probably failures more than anything. So to answer your question, I don't know if I have a good answer. It's if it's important to you, keep it on your desk or bundle it up and store it for your kids. It'll be a collector's item if it's not already. It was a time and a place for it, and it was very exciting. But it's gone now. That's over. So, anything else I can help you with?
I don't think so. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity to talk.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, thanks for that interview, Kevin. Antic was, like you said, one of the big two magazines. I had subscriptions to both Antic and Analog for years, and I'm actually slowly rebuilding my Antic collection.
Yeah, I'm doing the same thing, Brad.
It looks like we're at the end, and we wanted to thank you for listening to the show. We certainly welcome your feedback. Please take a minute to rate the show on iTunes. That's really the best way you can help us give you the podcast that you want. And also tell all of your retro computing friends. So please take 2 seconds to give Antic some stars. Also, do you have memories of the Atari 8-bits you want to share? Perhaps you're working on a project involving an Atari computer. Whatever it is, we'd like to hear about it.
Yes, we would.
You can contact us via voicemail at 206-984-1637 or via email at
antic@ataripodcast.com
or on Twitter at
@AtariPodcast.
Also, visit our website, There you'll find show notes and links to all the items we've talked about. And it's at www.ataripodcast.com. And we'll see you next time.
See you all later. Thanks for listening.